Talks.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Wars create veterans, and in the time since the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, an enormous number of veterans have been added to the ranks. North Carolina is home to 800,000 of them, and we are home to the third largest active military force in the nation, with nearly 120,000 active duty personnel and 12,000 members of the North Carolina National Guard. The Mecklenburg County area hosts over 57,000 veterans, the second largest veteran population in the state, and all of these people need access to health and social services. Making those services available is a major effort. Assessing the quality of that service is an ongoing process, as is figuring out how to improve the services provided. Well, next week, UNC Charlotte is hosting a conference to address those issues, and in advance, we have invited one of the keynote speakers to join us, retired Major General Marianne Mathewson Chapman, also has a PhD after her name and is an advanced registered nurse practitioner and former Deputy Surgeon General for the National Guard. Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Christine Elnitsky is a community health nurse specialist, a registered nurse and associate professor of nursing, and chairman of the Academy for Veteran and Military Health in the College of Health and Human Services at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for being here.
Good to be with you.
And we're also joined by Paul Passaro, a 22-year veteran of the U.S. Army. He is also state director for Concerned Veterans for America, and welcome to you, too.
Thank you for having me.
Why is UNC Charlotte, and I'll begin with you, Christine, why is UNC Charlotte conducting this conference to address veterans' health service needs next week?
Over 2 million service members have deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11/2001, and now they're coming home. So we need to be prepared to provide appropriate services for them that are both culturally appropriate and effective services.
I wanted to ask you about that because the conference is called Access to Culturally Competent Health Services Serving Military Veterans from a Holistic Perspective. What do you mean by culturally competent?
So the military culture has by some been described as being in a foreign country without a guidebook. But the military does have a culture and separate cultures within the military. For example, there are different values, beliefs, shared experiences among these soldiers, sailors, and airmen. They include a language that has a phonetic alphabet, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, as you may have heard, a military time clock that's a 24-hour day, acronyms, a lot of acronyms. Honor, courage, and commitment are part of their values. And other important components of that culture are a credo of self-sacrifice, that is, doing for the welfare of the team over and above the interest of the individual. These are also very service-oriented people. They are serving our country, protecting our freedoms as a population, and it's now our turn to welcome them home with open arms. I think maybe that's even been a bit long coming.
I want to explore that culture part of this a little bit more with our two military folks. Mm-hmm. Before I do that, you also talk about doing this from a holistic perspective. What do you mean by holistic?
Okay. So one thing we've heard a lot of in the news is about health issues, whether we're seeing advertisements about needing services for health problems coming home. But there are also social issues that veterans may struggle with. For example, financial hardships, loss of social support, stability of housing, transportation issues, in addition to the health issues that they may be dealing with. So from a holistic perspective, we would see health as something that is the outcome of both health and social services.
So we have two military folks with us, two military veterans with us, Dr. Marianne Mathewson Chapman and Paul Passaro. Talk to me about the military culture, and if this new is this a new approach to consider the military culture or the military culturalization of these people as they come home? Is this a new approach to talking to these men and women?
Well, I could begin on that one. First of all, I think it's the military culture, but it's increasing the awareness of our healthcare providers and our communities on what is this military culture so they're comfortable with it. What kind of questions to ask? Finding out from our returnees Why are they reluctant to ask for help? Because in the military, asking for help is a weakness. It's a sign of weakness. And so they're very hesitant to ask for help. They shouldn't have to. The system should be in place that coordinates all of these activities, everyone working together in different organizations, so that we can offer our services before they even have to ask for it. And it's not just the military culture for the veteran, but it's also the family members. The family members are the supports. They're the strength that keeps that warfighter having to not think about things, problems happening at home, because the family has pulled together to support that family member as he goes off or she goes off to war. So it's a culture that needs a lot of understanding, and that's why this conference is so critical, as well as when we write about working with providers and then working with our civilian providers, just so they know when you come in, the big question that's a big initiative right now is asking every one of your clients that comes in, have you ever served in the military? That hasn't been done before. But by doing that, you're opening up a whole entryway for civilian personnel to be able to ask and assess further avenues to help better the health care, the social services, or whatever the needs might be.
Let me ask a layman's question from a non-military person's point of view. We've been producing veterans in this country since the American Revolution and before, and we have produced a significant number of veterans since World War II. We're almost seemingly on a constant war footing, and I think the number of people, even during peacetime in our military, is now the highest it has ever been in the history of the country. So we have a lot of people who cycle into and cycle out of the military, and yet they grew up, as most of them grew up, in a civilian culture. So why is reacclimation so difficult? They are coming back to what they grew up into. Maybe that may seem a foolish and ignorant question, but I have to ask it.
No, that's a great question, and that's that is something that it's an experience of every veteran since World War II. And let's just think about that. How much training that we afford these civilians when they become service members, no matter what branch of service, how much training we give them, a year and a half sometimes before they go into combat. And then they are a group of people that they will stay with for a long time, and they know who has each other's back. And then we ask them when we sort of separate them, or they separate themselves from the military, to come back to a society that they're not prepared for again.
Why? Help me to understand why they're not prepared.
I think it's emotionally. Emotionally, they know 360 what to expect from everybody around them, what to expect from the military, from their commanders, from their subordinates. But when they come back, it's almost like a new world again. They just have to reacclimate. But it's almost like leaving Germany, coming back to the United States when they've been there for so long. Now they have to come back and just assimilate, or going from the United States to Germany. It's a totally different feeling, not only for them, but it's their family as well.
Is this thinking something relatively recent, or have we thought this way in the aftermath of World War I, in the aftermath of World War II, or did we learn things that we did wrong after those wars with veterans that we now are trying to correct with the veterans of Afghanistan and Iraq and even Vietnam?
I think we've learned through the years. The branches of service, the Department of Defense, hasn't always been great at helping prepare the departing service members for civilian life again with resume writing, with transitioning their skill sets from military to civilian skill sets and helping them. They're getting better at it, but we're not there yet. And so there's a lot of that anticipation and anxiety when they come back. Will I be accepted? You know, will I find a job? And remember, there are also Vietnam-era veterans that are here as well, and we never treated them.
Right.
But what we're treating the new ones coming out.
Well, many of them were miserably treated. These returning veterans, Doctor, present a number of challenges to the system. And by the system, I mean the Department of Defense, the Veterans Administration, and society at large that takes care of social and health needs. But you say that this is not the veterans' problem, but society's problem. We sent them to war to protect our freedom, and we are responsible for their optimal transition home to the new normal. I don't think that most Americans would argue with that statement, but the systems that we've set up don't seem to be ready, and some seem, and I'm talking about the Veterans Administration here now, almost clueless and callous. Why?
Well, I've had quite a few years, 13 years with the Department of Veterans Affairs, and they are changing their attitude because a lot of the employees are veterans. About a third of them are veterans, and that is increasing. So I think the systems are changing because they are realizing how significant this is. I would like to add, though, that thank you, Paul, on your introduction, but I represent the National Guard and the Reserves, and that's a whole nother piece of the pie. These members, this is the first major call-up since World War II with the National Guard, and all of a sudden you may have a very senior job in your civilian world, and you train a weekend a month and maybe several weeks or even longer for annual training. But then you are deployed, and you're deployed for 8 months to 12 months, and you're deployed frequently. So you don't have a lot of rest time back home. So you're constantly coming back and forth and always a worry that your civilian employer is going to say, enough is enough. You know, you're my senior manager. I can't have you gone for a year at a time, even though they can't fire them, but the pressure is there. So adding now to this mix of the reserve components, it's added a whole new awareness of what are we doing with our veterans. And I think that has brought it to the forefront from a lot of these organizations. Let's don't forget about the Guard and Reserve. They are the critical components and totally out there in the system, including the retired reservists. You are looking at 3 million backup. For our active duty force.
Well, that raises a question that's interesting. It's, as you were talking about it, Doctor, it almost reminds me of how women say if you are on the manager track and you decide to have a baby, suddenly you're not on the manager track anymore because they can't depend on you to be there for X number of months or whatever because suddenly you're a mother and you have other responsibilities. Is our society set up to be on a permanent war footing? When you have a situation where you bring up reservists, you call them into active duty, they cannot be fired, then they come home, and people have been substituting for them for months, maybe yeah. even a year, and they're expected to get their job back. It puts a terrible amount of pressure on the civilian workforce and the work opportunities, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and that's why we have these kinds of conferences and we talk with employers. The Guard has what's called set up the Employee Support in the Guard and Reserve, ESGR, which is a program that actually works directly with employers. So if you have a soldier, sailor, airman, marine that goes to the employer and say, I'm going to be deployed, and the employer says, oh, wait just a minute, and there's a conflict, then they have professional people that can come in and work with the employer. So the Guard and Reserve already know that this is a major issue, but they're in there to kind of in between the two to make things a little more palpable. Look what's going to happen. Look at the training he or she is getting when they're gone. When they come back, they're going to be a better employee. They're going to have the leadership skills and the management skills and plus the military culture. So that's happening. But your question is, are employers ready for this? They're working that way. I think this has been such a long war that people are not really positive on boots on the ground.
Yeah, and let me stop you there because we have to take a break. That's former Major General Marianne Mathewson Chapman. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Signature Healthcare Concierge Medicine with offices in Uptown and South Park, providing patients with 24/7 physician access, personalized executive healthcare, and same-day appointments. SignatureHealthcare.org. Tomorrow on this program, guest host Michael Tomsic will be here, and he'll be talking about the breaking of the color barrier in college basketball, which came late. The NFL was the first to integrate in 1946. Major League Baseball came along a year later than the NBA in 1950, but thanks to Dean Smith, it integrated here at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill when Charlie Scott came on board. Then Bill Chamberlain arrived, one of the first African-American basketball players that he recruited, that Dean Smith recruited to UNC Chapel Hill, and he will be among the guests talking about all of this tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the extremist group ISIS, which already controls large parts of Syria and Iraq, now claims responsibility for attacks in Libya. Understanding its connection to Islam, its strategy, and long-term objectives.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. Mike Collins. We're talking about the needs of returning veterans, both socially and health-wise, in advance of a conference sponsored by UNC Charlotte next week, Access to Culturally Competent Health Services, Serving Military Veterans from a Holistic Perspective. We have information about that on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Perhaps you are a veteran and have had trouble getting access, or have a good story to tell about access to social or health needs, or perhaps you have an idea on how Charlotte can help these veterans return and reacclimate, because we want to be, and we'll talk about this later, kind of a magnet for veterans. If you have some suggestions about that, you can join our conversation via email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. General, before we get to the another question about this, one of the things that you talked about was saying that this is a societal problem, not just the veterans' problem, and we want to be responsible for their optimal transition home to the new normal. We've heard the new normal used as a phrase with regard to the new economy after the recession, but you're talking about something different, I take it.
Right, absolutely. War changes everyone, not just the service member, but the family members. And when they do come home, you remember they've been gone for 8 months, and you were asking earlier, well, why can't they just adjust back in and be like they were? They can't. They've been gone for a year. They don't really, if they miss their kids' birthdays and their anniversaries, and potentially even Christmas, all the holidays with their family, soccer practice. The spouse at home has had to pick up the pieces and carry on, particularly plumbing problems or the car won't start, even though we've heard stories of spouses on the phone calling to their spouse in Iraq. You know, the car won't start today. What do I do? Mm-hmm. So he's not only fighting, or she's fighting, but now they're worried about the home life. So we've got programs to help to manage that. But it is quite an adjustment coming back, and it is a new normal. It's not what they were before, and they're trained in resiliency. That's the program that DOD is using right now to make them resilient to handling different changes without kind of going, bonkers because it wasn't like it used to be. I had a soldier tell me one time, you know, I came home and you won't believe what my wife asked me to do. And I said, what? And she asked me to take out the garbage. Now, I know I always used to do it before, but, you know, I've been at war. You know, I've had to protect my life. And now she's asking me to do something like this. So that's what I'm saying. It's a new normal. It's a new way of working with internally as well as with your family.
Dr. Marianne Mathewson Chapman is a former Major General in the U.S. Army National Guard. She'll be the keynote speaker at this conference next week. Paul Russo is also with us. He's a 22-year veteran of the Army and the State Director for Concerned Vets for America. And Christine Elnitsky. Dr. Christine Elnitsky is a community health specialist, associate professor of nursing, and chairman of the Academy for Veteran and Military Health at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Christine, the federal government has the Veterans Administration, which is set up to handle a lot of these returning veterans' services, but evidently they cannot do it alone. I guess we have so many people coming back, they can't do it alone. Your conference is stressing that meeting their needs requires interagency cooperation and collaboration among federal, state, and local civilian services. So talk about this. Is this a new realization, or have we known this for some time and are just trying to make it happen?
I think we have known it for some time. That is, our community resources are being used by veterans every day. The VA, in fact, doesn't serve all veterans, as all veterans don't come to the VA. In fact, the majority of veterans historically have come to community resources.
Why?
Partly because of the way that regulations have established the VA. Requirements set up a specific admission based on both need and disability. And depending upon your level of need, you may have greater amounts of access to the Department of Veterans Affairs. But the other part of the answer is often veterans are coming home and they transition successfully and they go into a civilian employment and they have health insurance through their civilian employer. Mm-hmm. So they'll be going to clinicians and providers in the community. And often, as we go back to this notion of the military culture, military often believe that the VA services are for people who have greater needs than they. They are opting to go to other services because they perceive that their colleagues in the military that may have disabilities that are more severe need that service more than they do. So they are giving again, yet again, they're the service person, allowing their members to go there.
Paul Passaro, I'm going to come back to another question about another ignorant question about reintegrating into this. Is it more difficult for today's young men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan to reacclimate, to get to their feet on the ground, to take out the garbage, than it was for a World War II or a Korea or a Vietnam veteran? And if so, why?
You know, it's a great question because I think it's dependent on the level of, let's just say, combat they saw. If they were more into the support role, more in the rear areas, just doing logistics and so forth, may not be as devastating. I think today, with all the unknowns that our guys face and our women face there with IEDs, with not knowing really who the enemy is, and coming back to an area, I actually, you know, when I in my former role before Concerned Veterans for America, I was working with a nonprofit, and we had to help assimilate veterans coming back to Charlotte. And I remember sitting across from this one 25-year-old Marine who said he just didn't want to go out and drive from Panera Bread back to our office. And the reason was because the trash cans were out and there were plastic trash bags that weren't in trash cans. And to him, that's how they had
threat.
IEDs.
That's a threat.
And so, yeah, so it is a little different now.
How much of it also has to do with the fact that World War II, for instance, was everybody was involved, everybody supported it, whether you went to the war or whatever you the whole nation was deeply entrenched in the war effort. Vietnam had political ramifications, and even though people didn't like the war, at least they had feelings, deep-seated feelings about the war. We either should be there or we shouldn't be there. And the soldiers kind of got caught in the middle. With this war, we saw it on television for a while, and then we just kind of forget about it. But we forget that there are thousands of people over there fighting. Is that part of the problem too?
Yeah, exactly. And the same thing happened after 9/11 when the Twin Towers went down. How did we all feel? Mm-hmm. And you just fast forward that 3 years, and it started fading from our memory. Today, we see the wars, we see the commercials on TV, and I think society is trying to keep it in the forefront. But at the same time, we are a nation that has less than 1% of our population has ever served. So that in itself makes it a difficult way to relate. Yes, you may have a family member there, and you may see a veteran come back, and he may have devastating wounds, and it sort of makes you feel bad. But then you go back to your iPad, you go to your phone, and you go to the movie, and it's sort of like it's a little bit disconnected today.
We're blithely unaware.
We are. Exactly.
The majority of the population.
That's a great point.
How much preparation do the various military branches give to the people mustering out? How much are there classes? Are there meetings? Are there handbooks that help these people know what to expect when they go back to civilian life?
I can answer that one.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I think we all woke up, VA, DOD, and said we've got to do better than what we've done before. And so early on, first of all, there was no linkages between DOD and our severely injured and to come to VA for their follow-on and rehab care. So the office was set up in VA called the Office of Seamless Transition that Dr. Elnitsky helped us with the evaluation piece to smooth that transition from active duty. We also had social workers, we had benefits counselors in each one of our active duty facilities. This was the first time that VA has really integrated to care for veterans through that whole continuum. after that, we realized that that was set up. We had care managers. We had folks taking care of those. But then we had this next group, mainly the Guard and Reserve, coming back. What can we do to prepare them for this transition reintegration? So we were able to get VA staff for the first time into each one of the demobilization stations that the reserve components came home. They received a mandatory transition assistant program briefing. They worked on employment. Department of Labor was there to work on a two-day workshop on how to fill out resumes. They were also learning about health care. They were learning everything else that they need to know and signing up for e-benefits. So that was the first time that we've ever had more of a personal approach come into the demobilization stations to prepare them to go home. And then DOD said, well, you know, we really need to look one more time at these folks, because now that they come home, they get a health assessment. But then we need to kind of do a second look at them at 3 to 6 months. And they come and they have developed what's called the post-deployment health reassessment. Again, one more time looking at their health care needs and injuries and anything that's now starting to surface now that they're home. Mm-hmm. So we've done a lot better for this group. They are learning about what the system is, how to access it, how to get on certain types of websites. But, of course, we still need to do much more because, again, those are all centralized. They're not, they don't tell you exactly back in Charlotte, this is what you're going to hook up with when you come back home. That's what we need, is communities. It takes a community to pull this knowledge together to be able to help when, you know, Sergeant Jones comes back to Charlotte, that he knows exactly, or she knows exactly, what type of services that are going to help me when I come back home.
Now, you've called, Paul, you've called the preparations that are provided for men and women coming back nonspecific and severely inadequate. Was that prior to all the things that Dr. Chapman just talked about, or is it still that way?
Well, she was talking a lot about the health care, but let's just talk about what happens at major installations when you're leaving. Let's just say from active duty. Fort Bragg is one that I know very well. Mm-hmm. They have a week-long now. It used to be a day when I got out, but now it's a week-long transition assistance program where you're taking, a website to look for jobs, but showing how to do resumes and showing a little bit of how to do interviews. And it's more focused right now on that, but it's the connectivity that is still lacking.
Is part of the problem here the fact that a lot of the young men and women who are serving now are young men and women? They are fresh out of high school. They've never had to put together a resume. They've never had to do a job interview. They went from high school right into the military.
That's exactly correct. That's it. Most of the people who come out of service now don't have college education. Mm-hmm. And those who come out with a college education normally are more well-footed to find a job. But at the same time, it's the move. It's where do I go find that job? Am I going to stay, for example, I'm retiring here or I'm getting out of service at Fort Bragg. Am I going to stay in Fayetteville? So where do I go? Do I go back home? I don't want to go back to North Dakota. I'm not saying anything wrong about North Dakota, but it's cold. And yeah. they came down south for a reason. So a lot of people are coming to Charlotte because of our banking area, the fact that we're close to the mountains, close to the beach, and they want to come to Charlotte. So Charlotte is still getting geared up for veterans that are coming home.
And there's not 8 feet of snow on the ground. Go ahead, Doctor.
It's also not – I think it's a little bit – complicated too. It's not just an age issue. That is, for example, you do have veterans who are leaving military service after 20 years or 27 years, and those folks have been in the military for their whole work life.
Right.
And so they don't necessarily understand all the different industrial sectors that they might be applying to. They may never have applied for a job. They may have gone into the military straight out of high school or even after some limited amount of college or beginning their college education. And so those folks actually have an uphill battle in trying to figure out exactly how to translate their skills and abilities from the military to a civilian.
Well, let's flip the coin around, because are civilian employers aware of how or even knowledgeable enough to understand how these people were trained, what they were trained to do, and how that those skills can be translated into a civilian job?
It's getting better, especially here in the Charlotte area. There are numerous organizations that are not only trying to educate the employers and their HR staff. The HR staff is a critical component as well, because while the employers and the executives may have a commitment to the veteran and providing jobs, it's that transition into the company, and what do you do when you get a veteran in there? I think that while we're committed to doing that, we also have to establish within each company some kind of a system or a group that welcomes veterans in, and sort of almost like a sponsorship program where you can say, well, here's how I got through my first couple of weeks, and here's what I think you need to do, and here's how the focus shifted for me, and here's the kind of things that I think would be important to you. So a veteran, it's sort of like training a veteran or sponsoring a veteran.
Dr. Olnitzky, you say that appropriate screening methods and effective treatments are needed for these folks, and that a RAND study suggests community providers across the nation are not prepared. Why not?
To meet the needs of these returning veterans. You know, the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs have training programs that may have enhanced the services in those organizations, and those providers may have provided for a lot of returnees that have these multiple complex comorbidities and injuries. But the majority of military won't be going to the VA. The providers in the civilian community may not have had this kind of training. They're certainly not receiving on a day-to-day basis a patient who presents with chronic unremitting pain, post-traumatic stress, and traumatic brain injury with the cognitive deficits that may be associated and the stressors.
So you're saying that people presenting with those situations are going to non-military health providers, and they don't understand what these people have been through, nor do they understand really how to treat that, because they don't see that in the civilian population?
Exactly.
Wow. How quickly can that change?
I think that's already beginning to change. So, for example, the Department of Veterans Affairs has some very innovative programs that we may not be aware of. For example, recognizing these returnees were coming back with these kinds of complex injuries and combinations, not just isolated individual injuries. They created several different systems, one polytrauma system of care, another an amputation system of care, and mechanisms by which they would integrate specialty care providers to meet the needs of these individuals. So now the civilian community may be able to benefit from that, but they also have training that VA is putting out into the community for clinicians in this community. In fact, there is some of that work, including toolkits and clinical practice guidelines for these kinds of patients that civilian providers might not see on a day-to-day basis.
I want to come back and ask Paul about a poll that was taken among the Concerned Veterans for America, which revealed strong support among veterans for health care options outside of the Veterans Administration. 88% of those polled advocated for increased health care choices, including access to private physicians, and 95% of these people said veterans should be entitled to the best care possible, regardless of the provider. I have a question about that, but I can't ask it right now because we have to go to the break. But I will ask you, Paul, when we come back. Paul Passaro is a 22-year veteran of the Army and the State Director of Concerned Veterans for America. Christine Olnitzky is with UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Marianne Mathewson-Chapman is a former Major General in the U.S. Army National Guard. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Acura. The fuel-efficient 2015 Acura RDX compact SUV features a 6-airbag and occupant position detection system and the ACE body structure. HendrickAcura.com. The extremist group ISIS, which already controls large parts of Syria and Iraq, now claims responsibility for attacks in Libya. Understanding its connection to Islam, its strategy, and its long-term objectives, the topic of the conversation on the Diane Ring Show. That's coming up 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or look for Facebook, or look for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back.
Hi, this is Don Gagne from NPR News. Does Morning Edition keep you company every single day? Are your weekends never without Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Car Talk, If your favorite public radio programs have become inseparable parts of your daily routine, well, you're not alone. Now we're counting on you to join the WFAE community to help pay for the programming that you depend on. Contribute online at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the needs of returning veterans in advance of a UNC Charlotte half-day conference next week, which we have information about on our website at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. The keynote speaker is with us this morning from Florida, Dr. Marianne Mathewson Chapman, former Major General, retired with the U.S. National Guard, an advanced registered nurse practitioner, and former Deputy Surgeon General of the National Guard. Dr. Christine Elnitsky is with us. She's kind of running this conference next week, if I'm not mistaken, is also the chairman of the Academy for Veterans and Military Health at UNC Charlotte. And Paul Passaro is a 22-year veteran of the Army and state director for the Concerned Veterans for America. So your organization took this survey, and 88% of those polled advocated being able to seek health care choices outside of the VA with private physicians. 95% say they should be entitled to the best care possible, regardless of the provider. Again, I don't think anybody would disagree with that, given what they've done. Will their voices be heard?
Well, we all want the best health care, no matter if we're a veteran or a civilian. I think that's incumbent on our society. But, yes, you know, let's think about this for a minute. What are the emergency needs of a person? It's normally the emergency room, an ER. Well, if you go to our Charlotte clinics, there's no ER there. There's no – the closest ER is in Salisbury, and even our new VA facility that's going to be built here is not going to have an emergency room. So the normal, you know, I broke my leg or whatever, or I have a severe cold, I need to go to emergency room. So in that respect, they need civilian care. But let's just look at the long wait list. The wait list for veterans sometimes within the VA system, and I'm not necessarily talking about Charlotte. We have a pretty good system here in Charlotte, and I'm part of the system here, and I go to the VA here. But there are some that have horror stories. I take one Nexium pill for acid reflux. Some of these guys are a lot more devastatingly injured than I am. So I'm not trying to downplay that. At the same time, if there's long wait lists, in Durham, for example, at one point in time, you had to wait over 100 days for a mental health appointment. Mm-hmm. And a mental health appointment needs to be seen pretty quickly. So I think when we're talking about choice, we're talking about waiting. We're talking about care. We're talking about, and well, there may be a specialist in the civilian sector that can handle my situation better. So the choice is, I think, is a requirement.
Well, you say, at least in Charlotte, the civilian healthcare community is severely lacking in mental health providers.
Yes. When we made a survey, this was about a year and a half ago, and both the major healthcare systems here, psychiatric care, they were short-staffed in psychiatrists. So coming back here and having veterans transition to Charlotte, for example, needing psychiatric care, the only place for them to get that would be at a VA facility, and a VA facility was backlogged.
So we have the situation now where the Affordable Care Act has provided health care to people who maybe have not had it to this point, either because they had pre-existing conditions or because they couldn't afford the health care and they didn't get it from their employer. So now they're able to go to a doctor. You combine that with these returning veterans who need to seek health care outside of the Veterans Administration because either they want to or because the wait time is too long to get it in the government sector. Do we have enough physicians? Do we have enough healthcare professionals to handle this influx of new patients? And I've stumped the panel. Yes, go ahead.
make sure that we talk about the Congress just passed the new voucher or the Veterans Choice Card program, which aims to help veterans go to civilian providers if they live over 40 miles from their doctors or can't get an appointment within 30 days. They're actually doing statistics on this now to see how widely used this program is being used by veterans. So they are coming up with some ideas, and they're saying, well, not too many veterans are using it, so potentially they're not interested in going to outside providers. So I think we're going to come up with some ideas, but your congressmen and senators are very interested in this program and feel that they should get the best care near home where they don't have to drive long distances for that, for care outside of VA. I'm also happy to hear that Charlotte seems to be a little more organized. I go to the VA Bay Pines here in Florida, and there's five VAs here plus one in Puerto Rico. A very busy state, as you know, with veterans here. And they are short of staff, but they now are actually looking at the numbers that they need. And I've been advertising like 25,000 providers. They're short. So they're out there doing massive recruiting. I know the new secretary has gone to medical schools. They're looking at paying potentially part of this program your school expenses if you're a psychiatrist, to encourage them to come work for VA. So they're trying all kinds of innovative ways to fill the gap of where there are shortages in certain specialties.
Dr. Olnitzky.
I think there's also, in addition to the psychiatrists and psychologists, we also have clinicians in other ilk, for example, social work or counseling, that may also be helpful in these situations. And so we might not think of all of those providers as being able to meet the needs, but if we think more broadly and look at this more holistically, all of those providers can provide some of those services. And it may be that we may have enough providers in that case. At the same time, those providers, again, one of our focus in the conference is even those providers still need to understand the culture of the military to know how to appropriately assess them and provide effective treatment services. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Dr. Chapman mentioned the Joining Forces Initiative and the need to include on our intake forms a question that just asks whether you've ever served in the military, which opens up a whole other set of questions that would be asked to assess potential exposures and possible illness and injuries.
The problems that they are presenting might be better understood, or having served in the military, might, if the doctor knew that, it might send up a red flag for him to say, well, let's look at this, because I would not have considered that in the civilian population, but you went to the military, maybe you served in Afghanistan, let's talk about this.
Correct.
Absolutely.
All of these services come at a cost. And Dr. Chapman, you have said that we should not worry about the cost now, because these costs should have been identified prior to sending our men and women into combat. Again, I think most Americans would agree with that, but I don't think it was considered before we started these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Why not? Why have we committed tens of thousands of people to these combat situations with not a nanosecond of thought, evidently, about how we're going to deal with them when they come back?
And I agree. Why haven't we done that? And I think shame on all of us. Because we send them off to do the mission, and then they come back. Because this is going to be a long term. These mental health conditions are not going to be cured once officially everyone's out of the Mideast. And that's kind of frightening, because when it comes to funding the VA, for instance, and that's where we really need the community involvement, because community needs to have resources, and maybe federal government, the state gives community, these small organizations, funding to run to do that they can't do.
In his State of the State address, Governor McCrory here in North Carolina announced the development of the state's first Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. It's a cabinet-level agency reporting directly to the governor. What impact do you think that might have on making things better for veterans who are returning to North Carolina?
I think that's a great step forward. First of all, the governor is sincere in his commitment to the military and to veterans. At the same time, there are so many other issues that we have to focus on other than sometimes just the veteran itself. If you look at the proliferation of nonprofits that have been established that Governor McCrory is aware of, and the Veterans Affairs Director will be aware of as well, that have tried to come to the aid of the family members, the caregivers, you know, that aren't really part of the VA system, can't even utilize the VA system, or, you know, so there's some things out there that could exacerbate the problem with the veteran if it not looked at and try to get a little bit ahead of the game. So that's part of it. But back to your question on veteran and his new program, he's traveled to Fort Bragg. I've seen him on Fort Bragg before he was a governor as well. I've seen him even go down to South Carolina, to Columbia, and just to see what the issues are. And at this, while he's doing that, he's talked to veterans, he's talked to family members. And I think getting those survey, that survey together, when he took over, we knew there was going to be changes, but I think the changes are going in a totally positive direction.
The governor also announced two additional veteran treatment courts to provide veterans a tailored mental health and substance abuse recovery program. Now, drug courts here in Mecklenburg County are consistently underfunded, but they also consistently are successful in helping people who are addicted to substances kick that addiction, and not treat them like criminals, but treat them like the health issues that they are. Do you think that this kind of a court system for veterans will be equally effective?
I think it's a great step forward. Other communities and other states have these, and they've been successful. It depends on the attitude towards the veteran, and it depends on if you're trying to help the veteran or just give him a break. Veterans sometimes, and I don't mean to say this in a degrading way, but veterans like children. If you just give them an inch and they'll take a mile. At the same time, you have to make sure that there's a program in line there that they have to adhere to, and a court system that that follows those guidelines, and they're already established.
Is having a State Department, the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs at a cabinet level, is that something unusual, or do other states have something like that in their state governments as well?
Most of the states that I've been in have those already in place. And in fact, North Carolina does have, at the present time, a division of Veterans Affairs that falls under the administration. Office of Administration.
So is this added level something, are we playing catch up, or is it something that we're doing because, and we should talk about this, we want to be a magnet for veterans. We want veterans to return from these conflicts and come to North Carolina as opposed to anywhere else in the country.
As I understand it, it's because of the latter. That is, North Carolina wants to be the state of choice.
Why?
For veterans. For a variety of reasons. One, we do have a lot of richness in the veteran population. They bring a lot of skills and abilities, and they're certainly committed to the mission of the organization that they work for. So that's a value that we certainly can't turn away. Second, you know, as students at universities, they're very valuable. These are folks that are committed to accomplishing the mission that they're facing, that is continuing with their education, moving on to the next employment role. So I think they're a desirable population to have here.
We've actually done a couple of shows about what the University of North Carolina, Charlotte particularly, does for veterans and the problems that those people face when they go into a classroom after years of combat or in support of combat in a foreign land. These people come back and they are mature. They've had more lifetimes than any of these students will have in their lifetime in many cases. And that's part of they face a difficulty sometimes in fitting in because these are serious people. They're not kids trying to grow up. They've already grown up.
They do have some difficulties with transition in education. In fact, the students in my studies, one, for example, explained on January 7th, he was fighting in Afghanistan. On January 9th, he was at UNC Charlotte in the classroom with students from Iraq and Afghanistan. These kinds of adjustments, moving from the military culture into the civilian culture, make it very difficult for them. This student had difficulties with anxiety being in that environment. He was telling me he took alcohol in the morning to be able to tolerate the anxiety and be in the classroom.
Right. Last year they broke ground here in Charlotte on the Charlotte VA Healthcare Center on Tyvola Road, which I believe you just alluded to, Paul. It hasn't opened yet, but when it does, what impact will that have on serving veterans?
No, personally, I think it's going to be a great facility. Right now you have in the Charlotte area, people have to go to Salisbury if they can't be seen, you know, if their issue can't be seen at the let's say the clinic at University East. And at the same time, having that clinic in Charlotte not only will bring more veterans to this area because of the healthcare system, but it'll also give an idea of what it's going to take to that it's going to ramp up. It's going to ramp up over time. And as more veterans come, it's going to ramp up. But that facility itself, the only lacking thing I see, it's going to serve about 97% of issues. emergency room is the only one that I see is lacking right now.
Yesterday, it was announced that the Walmart Foundation was expected to announce, I don't know whether they did or not, but they were expected to announce that they're giving $1 million to put Charlotte at the forefront of a new approach to helping recently discharged veterans to more easily connect to jobs and services and educational opportunities. What can you tell us about that,
Dr.? I didn't see whether the event went off with the bad weather and closings yesterday, but I did see the report in the news. It's a wonderful development. I understand that the governor's work group on veterans, military, and their family members are supporting this kind of effort. In fact, the report had a quote from Ilario Pantano, our current director of Veterans Affairs, who is, by the way, another keynote speaker at our conference next week. So we're looking forward to hearing about the sort of package of things that are coming forward. I'm sure that the governor's work group involvement with the VA and providing the treatment guidelines for clinicians in the community is also going to be a help to us here.
I have about 30 seconds left. We've talked about a lot of challenges in the health and social services area for these people and a lot of challenges for the private sector as well to deal with them. Are you optimistic that we will be able to take these challenges on and succeed with them?
I am.
I think Charlotte's well-suited and poised to meet the needs of this population.
Dr. Chapman, very quickly.
Yes. And I think nationally people are starting to wake up. Again, it's constantly is to, again, public awareness at all levels.
Dr. Marion Mathewson Chapman, retired Major General in the U.S. Army National Guard and former Deputy Surgeon General in the National Guard, will be a keynote speaker at next week's conference at UNC Charlotte, about which we have information on our website. Dr. Christine Elnitsky and Paul Passaro also with us in our studio here. Thank you all for the hour.